listening to Uncharted Pages, the book review podcast where we read and review The War of the Spark novel by Greg Weisman. I am your host, David Wolfe, and I'm joined here by my co-host,
Alan Harrison.
And Al, we've got a doozy this week. We were absent last week. That was my fault. I was a bit sick. We decided to put off the podcast for my health. But yeah.
Well, I'm sure reading this book is going to be very beneficial for your health.
Yes. Not beneficial for my rage.
Oh, all that rage. Despite all my rage, I'm still an uncharted page.
Oh, I thought you were going to go somewhere with a rat.
Oh, yeah, that's much better. Oh, my God, speaking of rage, actually, will it come up in this episode? No, it won't, actually. I will say, as a spoiler, maybe for you as well, we later on learn about Rat's ability. And do you know about Rat's ability yet? Why she is unseen from other planeswalkers, other people?
No.
Well, we learn in a few chapters from now, and boy, is it disappointing.
Oh, damn it.
Yeah. Abari won't come up here, but yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Prepare to be whelmed.
Okay. Probably we're going to be talking about just two chapters today because they're quite long. So first up we have Ral Zarek. So where we last left off, all the planeswalkers were heading to the Azorius Senate in order to convene some kind of a meeting because their attack had failed. They'd been defeated by the God Eternals, blah, 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 blah. So now they're in the Azorius Senate, but Ral is thinking to himself that it's a bit unfortunate because the corpse of Isperia, the previous Azorius guildmaster who had been turned to stone by Vraska, in an, you know, a series of events that we never got to see in this book. So we're just seeing the aftermath here, and it's all being explained to us very annoyingly. That's, you know, her corpse is still sitting in the middle of the Azorius Senate chamber as a visible reminder of the discord that exists in the between the Ravnica guilds. And yeah, we get kind of a full rundown of the guilds and where everybody is at in this chapter. And once again, I'm going to have to say, you can clearly just imagine the visuals. Like, it would work so much better as a video game or whatever. You can imagine, like, the name of the guild and the symbol coming up on the screen in a big splashy kind of neon colors as we see, as we get like a little voiceover set to a montage about what the guild is doing right now. And that's basically what happens in this chapter, but in text form, so it's far less exciting.
Yeah, I'm imagining the that anime everyone loves. My God, has really funky opening music, very 90s. Has bongos. Like a big brassy.
Is it the one with
what's it called?
With the giant?
No, not that. No.
No.
Oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking at this. Samurai? No, not samurai. Oh my God, I'm an idiot.
I don't know any.
I can't believe I can't remember this.
Basically.
Jesus Christ. Anyway, but kind of like a montage you can see like in Ocean's 11. That kind of like, you know, bongos. It's like, yeah, so that's what I'm sure that's what he was going for. Cowboy Bebop. That's what it is. Jesus Christ. Okay. Can't believe I forgot that. Cowboy Bebop. Yeah. So imagine the opening theme for Cowboy Bebop as is happening.
I lack.
But yeah, it's
the necessary knowledge to imagine that, but I can try.
Yeah, it's just, it is very good, very good theme song. So if you listen to the theme song, then you will have to do that. But this same kind of sequence we've done before, where it has been kind of broken up like this. It was a Jace chapter previously, where it was these headlines, and yeah, we had the same comments of how strangely stylistic it was. And it's like, it's just going up so strangely. And I think another thing that kind of harps back to the point, we're making this point a lot, that it really is just like Greg is visualizing this. He's just telling us how it would play out in his head rather than telling a story. Like even something like, you know, Isperia's corpse being there as a stark reminder of the discord on Ravnica. It's like, that's like really cool and symbolic. But like, it's like she died ages ago. I mean, it seems very unrealistic that they just leave her there. After she died.
Well,
it's like
I think it's fine because she's when we say died, like she turned to stone. Vraska turned her to stone, so she's basically a giant statue, and she's really big. So I guess they just haven't been able to move her.
Yeah, that's very true as well. Yeah.
Well, I think it's fine, but again, it's still really visual. Like she's not really described very well, other than she's a big stone sphinx. And I guess maybe just the word Sphinx is enough, but I don't know. I feel like a better book would describe her in more detail. I feel like she's a key...
Oh, absolutely.
A key part of the backdrop of the scene, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. This will be something that we'll see this again when we're introduced to Borbrig most later on. Not in this episode, it'll be later on, but yeah, he's not described. It's like Greg just assumes we know what a Cyclops is. When he's describing Borbrig Rose, same way like this, then yeah, he's assuming we know what it thinks is without describing what his beard looks like.
And I mean, I think it is fair enough to assume people's knowledge of things like Sphinx or Cyclops because they're, you know, they're real world things. But like the real world Sphinx in real like Egyptian mythology or whatever, like people just think of the statue with the head of a woman and the kind of the headdress. And the lion's body, they don't really think of the wings or anything like that, or the big tail or any, you know, they don't think of Ravnican sphinxes. Like sphinxes are slightly different on every magic world. So I think it's doing a disservice not to describe them. And it's the same thing with the Cyclops, you know, like in magic, Cyclopses are a race. You know what I mean? They're a type of creature, but in real ancient Greek mythology, the Cyclops was like the one dude. He was one actual creature, not a race of creatures. So the way the magic does it is unique and is worth describing.
Yeah. When I read up our previous chapter, I thought that too much in this chapter that we haven't got that we're not going to do today. But I did look up Cyclops, and actually the Cyclops were a race, were like a collective. This was in Homer's Odyssey.
I thought it was
just one. Yeah. So did I. I was sure it was this one, but you know, it is the land of the Cyclopses.
Oh, okay. Well, disregard what I said then.
We'll do a deep dive in Homer's Cyclops in a later episode. Don't you worry, listeners.
Excellent. All right. Just the another thing that adds to kind of the like adventure movie theme of this chapter, like that kind of lighthearted, let's check in with everyone, is like the amount of punning that's going on. There's like a lot of jokey little quips and things like that. So like there's this part that I want to read out. So they're kind of checking in with the Orzov syndicate, and as we know, Kaya is the leader of the Orzov, but she's kind of the begrudging leader. So she went to the Cathedral Opulent, as we mentioned before, and she tried to get all the Orzov on her side, but it didn't really work out. So she has here, when they said they would stand behind me, their words translated to far behind me. They could barely stifle their contempt long enough to pay me lip service. No, then Ral replies. See, that's where you went wrong, he said ruefully. You should have known they were stingy about paying anything, lip service included.
Boom. Oh, that's fair. It's not quite clever, but it's a strange tonal shift. Ral, silver-tongued devil. After he said this, you know, we do get the line, she ignored the crack.
Yeah.
She refers to the crack.
She's not into it. Having none of it.
No, none of the crack. I had issue with the mirror segment. I wrote down I had an issue with it, but I didn't write down what the issue was.
Each segment is very, very short, so we can just have a quick look at it here.
Yeah. I'll it's a few lines there, so I'll just read it. It says, Ral also took it for granted that Demir's shape-shifting guildmaster, Lazav, was present in one form or another. As head of the spy guild, Lazav loved to play his little games, but so far he had been surprisingly cooperative. Not trustworthy, but cooperative. And like Aurelia, Lazav was practiced. Bolus was bad for business. Who will hire an assassin if everyone in your world is already dead? I think it's like that kind of, it's, I suppose, reading that by itself does really help. But it's everything. All the other guild segments we're seeing are like happening. It's like it's more so that we have this headline kind of splash, but it is dialogue between Ral and somebody else. As we get the update, whereas that one was like that seemed like it was talking about it in the past. That they're kind of like, wait, so when is this happening? Is this happening now? Is Ral thinking this? Just a little bit unclear to me.
Yeah, I guess this is where it breaks from the visual thing, because it's kind of like, if this was visual, it would just be a close-up of Ral's face going, wonder where Lazav is. Maybe he's here now. Maybe.
That's not exactly, yeah.
And I like the way, after this, after Demir, after Demir, Greg just kind of like shrugged his shoulders and gave up and said, ah, fuck it, we'll put the rest of them all together. The Kul Dorakdos, the Golgari Swarm, the Gruul Clans, we'll do them all together at the same time.
Yeah, I realized that as well. It's like as he's writing it, he was like, you know, oh yep, I've written a 6 of them. That's a good day's work. Oh, what? There's 4 more? Oh, for fuck's sake! I'll group as many as I can together then.
And then he gets onto the Azorius, which is the last one, and then you kind of remember, you're like, oh yeah, wait, like Dovin Ban, who's the leader of the Azorius now, like he's against them, he's with Bolas. So like, how are they okay to just stand around in the heart of Azorius territory? And then they're like, oh, he's in one of the towers looking after the immortal sun. He's fine. We no danger to us. Like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
One of the towers and they can just freely use his, like, guild hall?
Yeah, it's very strange. He's, is it the beacon? Oh, sorry, yeah, sorry, I was thinking of the beacon, because there is the beacon, which we learn, is in the beacon tower. But yeah, he's looking after the immortal sun.
And then we get this, after checking in with all the guilds and, like, oh, how many guilds do we have supporting us? Blah, 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 blah. Ral makes a big point of, oh, we need all the guilds behind us. He's like, 50% support won't be enough, no matter how we squeeze this, because they want to, what do they want to do? The only option is Operation Desperation, which, like, literally a 5-year-old could come up with that name.
I hate that so much. And you know what? They keep on referring back to it as a funny thing. Operation Desperation. It's like, it is like a child wrote it. So dumb. Because we're supposed to be told that Ral is this genius. Come put a better name than Operation Desperation. But it rhymes. Very good, Ral. Very good.
I mean, it's kind of hinted that Niv-Mizzet actually came up with it. Because, well, no, it says, hold on. It says, with the Firemind dead, the only option is Operation Desperation. For that to succeed, you'll need cooperation from 10 of 10 guilds, so all the guilds. There can be no exceptions. Ral nodded. Her assessment matched his calculations. His calculations. Counting to 10. It was
7 and 3.
It was the first time he'd ever hoped Marie might have better math. 10 of 10, there can be no exceptions. Then he says, Bring me options.
Yeah.
Then he have options. He just needs all 10 guilds. That's it. There's no options to be had.
Yeah, the dialogue is so silted and strange here. and that he keeps on kind of,
hold on. The next line is insane. Hold on. Bring me options, Ral said, knowing full well there were none. But Marie nodded curtly and dutifully walked away to find some. Just find some options lying around. You know, we might have some options in a press or something.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that line was hilarious. Even just her dutifully walking away before to find options and to find options to find some. And that does push it over the line. But nodded curtly and dutifully walked away. So yeah, she better find some options. And I feel like this is a bit of dialogue that just doesn't go anywhere. I don't think we come back to Marie and her options.
Not for a while, certainly. Well, I mean, I've only read up to the next chapter, so I can't really, I can't confirm or deny.
Yeah, I think this happened early on in this chapter, which I thought was quite amusing. At one point. I think I'll pass it. But basically, I can't find actual text, but it's one point he blames himself for Hesperia's death, and he's like, it was my fault this happened. His internal struggle and dialogue, and then he's like, well, it was my fault and Vraska's fault as well. It's like, oh yeah, that's a great hot take there, Ral. The person who killed Hesperia is responsible for her death. Well done. That's great. It's like I've written here. Do you want to hear a historical hot take on along the same lines as Ral's Eric?
Yeah.
So, you know, you could say that Emperor Franz Joseph is somehow responsible for the death of Archduke Ferdinand, as it was really he who ordered Ferdinand to go to Sarajevo to observe the military movements in June 1914. So really, it was Emperor Franz Joseph who was responsible for Franz Ferdinand's death. Oh, and also Serbian nationalist Gabriel Princip, who, you know, killed him.
Yes, that is equivalent, indeed. I found the part that you're talking about, actually. It's in his description of Boros.
Oh, yeah.
It's that old reliable angel of order and combat, Guildmaster Aurelia of the Boros, was, of course, one of the first to arrive. She gazed angrily from Hesperia to Ral, as if blaming the Storm Mage for the Sphinx's death, which was fine, since he pretty much blamed himself. And then it's in italics. Well, myself and Vraska, anyway.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I like how he barely says anything about Boros in the Boros part.
Yeah, it's all about him. He was turns the story around to be more about him. It's like, yeah, they always say that writers should avoid using adverbs. Adverbs are So basically, if you just go through a manuscript and take out all the adverbs, the story, the prose will just read a lot better. Stuff like, you know, if you want to say, oh, David said sadly, you'll take out sadly and replace it with a physical beat to get across the idea of sadness. So I'm very much kind of primed to see adverbs as being like a sign of like a not good writer or something that wasn't edited properly, which I guess is pretty unfair, but it's just kind of the way I see things. But I think out of all the adverbs, I think the adverb angrily is just like the most laughable. It's so hard for me to take, the word angrily serious, that she gazed angrily at Ral. It's like, angrily? What's that? Reminds me of, I think in school, in English, we're learning how to write, a letter of complaint. Yeah, because letters of complaint existed in the early 2000s. And I remember
a
friend of the podcast, ooh, maybe he's listening, David Leonard Scully. He might be listening. He started listening to the early episodes. Maybe he got this far. I think he joked about signing his letter of complaint and said, "Yours sincerely," signed it, "Yours angrily, David Leonard Scully."
Yours disappointed.
Yeah. Because angrily is such a bad word to use in a description. It's very, very poor.
Yeah, it's not great. Also, point of order, I still teach my students how to write letters of complaint.
Oh, really? Okay. That's fine. So I guess you are relevant.
I mean, they're usually emails now, but teach them how to make it a letter if they really want to.
Did you teach them how to write nasty comments on online articles about celebrities?
No. Should I?
No, because it's something that I maybe this is more of a bad part on my part. I was on Facebook. I saw an article. It was such a terrible article of like someone from Love Island. It's like, this person from Love Island didn't even smile as she walked into this hotel, and she was guarded by a bodyguard. And it was a star. It was such a non-headline. And it's like, you know, there's been a lot of discourse about the mental health of people on reality shows. You know, people had taking their own lives to being on, who've been, you know, the victims of abuse from being on Love Island in the past. So it was such a toxic, article. And I looked at the comments. I just wanted to see what kind of discourse was happening in the comments. And in fairness, the vast majority of the comments were all people saying, like, this is a disgusting article. How dare you write this? She's only a 19-year-old girl who doesn't have to smile with the cameras. And she's allowed to have this. But then some woman wrote, oh, well, you know, she's going to need a bodyguard to protect her, to protect all the pies from her because she's fat. And it's such a terrible thing for someone to say. This happened literally before we started recording this. I replied. So this woman had lots of replies to her, people laughing or people saying that she's terrible. I wrote a reply to her, and her name's Linda. And I said, Linda, nobody will ever love you.
Oh my God. That's needlessly harsh.
Yep. He deserved it. That's something I always write that under. I always write that under Dan Bilzerian's photos when he has photographs of himself with his half naked, half high class prostitutes on a yacht. Say, Dan, no one will ever love you.
Well, we all know about your long standing feud with Dan Bilzerian.
It is. It's begun on long enough. But anyway, sorry, we've gone off topic. But I hope you teach your students only to write letters of complaint. And not toxic comments on news articles.
No, I would never teach that skill.
That's good. You gotta sign those off as yours angry.
God. Okay, so I mean that's pretty much the end of the chapter. There's a bit of back and forth between Kaya and Ral of worrying about Tomek. They still don't know where Tomek is. The last little paragraph here is kind of weird to me. Like, there's an intimacy and a friendship that's kind of hinted at there that I feel has not been earned throughout the rest of the character development. So it's, let me read maybe the last kind of couple of paragraphs.
Yeah.
I don't think Tomek...
Sorry, you mean a friendship?
Yeah, a friendship between...
Sorry, you mean between Ral and Kaya?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I just don't particularly feel like they've been allies up to now, but I just didn't really feel like they were close or anything. I think it's Kaya who says, so she thinks that there's like she doesn't think, she knows that there's a bit of an uprising against her in the Orzhov guild, led by Tesa Karloff, who is the daughter of a previous guild master. So she says, in fact, given the lack of cooperation I'm receiving, the thoughts cross my mind that Taysa is attempting to strike a new alliance with the dragon behind my back. And Tomek works with Taysa. She says, I don't think Tomek would willingly participate in that, but it might explain his absence. It was an upsetting thought, but it beat the possible alternative, Ral's greatest fear, that the Eternals had found Tomek before Ral, Kaya, or Taysa. And then here's the last paragraph that I have a problem with. Kaya took Ral's hand and squeezed it. She whispered, I'm sure he's all right, but she sounded more hopeful than convincing.
Yeah, this is, I feel like this is going to be a problem that book is going to have a lot more going forward as, like, relationships between characters are established or kind of are forced to grow. That because there's so many characters and there's so much of the nonsense in this book is just stuff being described as happening, where we've had very little interactions between characters. We had very few honest conversations between two characters. Like, every conversation has been to forward a story somewhat or to deliver exposition. Like, we never had Jace and Gideon having a chat about, I don't know, something. The conversations, say, Quentin Tarantino was famous for having in his scripts. Just, characters just talking about random shit and developing characters that way, developing relationships that way. So the relationships in this book are so poorly established because the characters really don't talk to each other like characters would. This year is like almost like a payoff for, it will be a payoff for a build relationship in previous chapters, but that build just hasn't happened. Everything else has been so jam-packed with exposition and pushing the forward story that, yeah, we never had our characters, really interact.
I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, that we don't have opportunities for characters to just have a chat with each other. Literally, the book started off with the spirit dragon and the dragon spirit having a chat.
That is right, a little chat. And that was a nice little chat. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, and we have had moments between Rat and Teo that were kind of like touching and like interacting without, being under pressure from the story. So I suppose, yeah, we have seen that. You just haven't seen this. We've seen it out of whatever it is, the 36 Planeswalkers, all the characters in the story, it's going to be, I don't know, 36 times, 36 to the power of 2 or whatever, for like a huge number of possible interactions, of possible relationships, that it feels like, obviously, a very small proportion of them are going to be established. And I feel like this one between Kaya and Ral are not even foreshadowed.
Yeah, maybe like it would be clearer again if we had that other book that's coming, because I think that kind of into the setup for the whole thing, so it might cover their alliance a bit more and the start of their friendship and how it develops a little bit. So again, bit of backstory that we're missing here.
That last book probably was quite important for...
But yeah, I do feel like it's very... Like, most of the interactions in the book are very, very surface level. Like you said, they just push the plot forward. They don't really feel earned or genuine, or like this character has this trait that is being expressed through their friendship with this person, or they're not developing or growing in many ways. As you said, the stuff between Rat and Teo is the only thing that approaches that. And even then, like approaches is probably generous.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, just to talk about the first book, do you know, did Greg Weisman write that as well, or was that a different author?
Well, there's different things going on. I think there's a series of short stories by a guy called Django Wexler. I want to say that he wrote short stories, but I think the other book is not by Greg Weisman. No, I don't think it is. I know that there is another book coming out by Greg Weisman to continue this story, I think.
I think the one that's coming out, I think it's October or November, is by New York Times bestselling author Greg Weisman, is a sequel to this. So now I feel like the story that preceded this, maybe we'll just never see it, because it's kind of past the time where you could say, hey, this book that came out a few years ago or a few months ago, here's the thing that should have come before it. But so the point I was going to make was that even if this relationship between Kai and Ral was established in the previous book, there's still, I mean, we had a lot of screen time with the two of them already, so there could have been plenty of opportunities to kind of reinforce that relationship, even if it was established previously. Something that J.K. Rowling was quite good at doing was, even if you just pick up, say, the second Harry Potter book, not reading the first one, when she introduces the characters, when Harry's meeting all the characters again, back in his second year at Hogwarts, it's like, she very quickly reestablishes all the characters, and we get a little bit of exposition, a little bit of insight. We go see him you know, we see him interact with Draco Malfoy, we see him interact with other characters. So we quickly establish the roles and relationships the characters have, even though, like, this all happens at the start of the Chamber of Secrets, even though we already saw these in detail in the previous book. So there's really, like, no reason for that not to happen here. Like, a lot of stuff, like, we have brought up a lot that there is a lot of information missing from this because it was in the previous book. That even though there are two separate books, if they're written by two different authors, we still should be seeing a little bit in here.
Yeah, I just did a bit of looking there, and I think the prequel one is out now. Yeah, it's Django Wexler is the guy who wrote it. Yeah, so I think possibly these short stories that have been released periodically, they are that prequel novel. I think it's being released chapter by chapter or something like that. I think it's all out now, or almost all out. So that stuff is available there if we want to go and look at it. But I don't want to go and look at it. I want to just continue to complain.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I'd like to read more of Greg's stuff because it is entertaining.
Yeah.
But got it.
All right. Let's move on to the next chapter, which is Gideon Jura, and this is a doozy of a chapter, so we probably get a lot out of this one.
When you say doozy, do you mean it's going to be long? But what does it mean?
I mean, doozy means, like, a big one, right?
Okay, I suppose I feel like I'd almost interpret it as being the opposite, an easy one? Doozy.
No.
Okay, maybe I've just been wrong. Troublesome or problematic, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is quite troublesome and problematic. Doozy.
Gideon and Jace. Two sides, Gideon thought, of the same scarred coin. Wow. That is
very heavy-handed.
I don't even know where that's come from. How are they two sides of the same scarred coin? Like, I guess they're they both have been de facto leaders of the Guildwatch at certain points, but I don't know. It's just
I kind of expected. Does it come back and elaborate on that later on in the chapter? That, you know, does the chapter open and close with this imagery? I don't think so.
I think he does come back to it a little bit. I think in their thoughts, Gideon and Jace, like, compare themselves to each other a lot. So I think it's actually fine in the context of the book. I'm more annoyed in the context of, like, the characters as we know them in the wider story. I'm just like, that doesn't make sense to me at all. They're not two sides of the same scarred coin. They're just people who know each other and fight together sometimes. Friends, maybe.
I'm trying to avoid being unfair, having unfair criticisms to Greg, but I feel like so often it just feels so smug when he makes these analogies or has his symbolism that so often, like, say with Hesperia, being like, oh, she was in the Guildhall and she was she symbolized the turmoil of Ravnica. Aren't I clever? That so often he just really highlights when he has this interesting symbolism and when he has characters music like this, it just feels very inorganic. And like we're saying, it seems kind of outside of Gideon's character to basically kind of use like this. And then again, it's like, are they really different coins? Same coin, different sides?
I mean, maybe there's like a brains and brawn thing being put forward here, but I've always felt like the portrayal of Gideon in this novel as like pure beefcake. The way he characterized himself earlier as, like, he was no general, only a soldier, weapons master. Yes. But I feel like that's really and not really doesn't really follow Gideon's character until now, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He is very, very flat. And it's when you say, oh, this character is a dumb beef slab, it's like, there's not really much more you can do with that.
I mean, I feel like Gideon's whole character has been very, like, emotionally deep for a long time. Like, he's like a tortured kind of character. So when you set your character up that way, it kind of confers some intelligence upon them. It doesn't make them just a dumb brick.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, there is kind of conflict between the imagery of Gideon being a dumb brick, but also Gideon being a strategist, like a military strategist.
Yeah.
So he's got it. Is he?
In this first page here, we get a bit more about Hesperia. I want to just read this full first kind of page of the of this chapter because it's just shite, I think. So Gideon and Jace. Two sides, Gideon thought, of the same scarred coin. Stood in front of Hesperia, former guildmaster, champion, and lawbringer of the Azorius Senate. Current ornamental statue of the Azorius Senate Hall. That is just
So disrespectful.
It is funny, actually. I think it is funny, but it's maybe not funny for the reasons that it was intended to be funny.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite dumb.
And then we get some quips from Jace. Sphinxes, Jace muttered with no little disgust. Bigger troublemakers than dragons. Gideon raised an eyebrow. Catching Gideon's unspoken question, Jace seemed to actually struggle before belatedly and begrudgingly offering up a slight correction. Then all dragons but one. So there's your adverb issue in one sentence. Jace seemed to actually struggle before belatedly and begrudgingly offering a slight correction.
Yeah, belatedly. Belatedly seems like we're aware in a passage of time. I think this is fine with it, belatedly. The physical movements and the physical description of Jace here, it's already described as being, it already comes across as being begrudging and being belated. There's just really no need to tell them. Really no need to say it. That is quite bad.
Yeah, I feel a description of physical action, like maybe Jace tilted his head in consideration or something. I don't know, some physical action.
Yeah.
Like you said before, some kind of physical beat would be much more effective than all these adverbs.
Yeah, exactly. It's like if you're using an adverb, you can probably do without it. And if you can do without it, then don't have it. It's either redundant or could be the better.
Just a little bit later on, they're talking about Asperia, and Jace defends Vraska and her killing of Asperia because Vraska, when she was younger, had a lot of poor treatment at the hands of the Azorius. And as we all know, Jace is in love with Vraska now. So then Gideon has a few thoughts about that. And he says, who is Vraska's Jace? More than just an assassin, obviously. Obviously.
It's just strange, like, what, it's your job? So it's like saying,
more than just a
teacher. I don't know, if you suspect, yeah, more than just a teacher, yeah, like, who is Sonya to you, David? I think this Sonya girl is more than just a teacher.
It's yeah.
Like, what?
Even teacher is, like, a bit different from that one, because at least when you're a teacher, you have, like, a somewhat of a close relationship working closely with people, but it's like, this one probably is more like, who is Vraska to Jace? More than just an engineer, obviously.
Yeah, like more than just a plasterer for his house. It's like, yeah, that is gas.
Then he thinks Liliana, now Asperia's killer. Jace sure can pick him. Sure can. That is a very, I don't like that phrase. It's a very,
sure can pick him, yeah.
Such a kind of a hackneyed, boring phrase.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's such it's almost. I feel like I know exactly what's happening. It's like he kind of wants Gideon to make a joke about it, but he's basically just picked the worst possible way to phrase it. He's kind of joking, saying, "Oh, Jace always has picks crazy lovers." But like, he sure can pick them. It's almost like unclear. I think there's so many different ways to put this that it could be a lot better. And and the sure can pick him is like, so something got, I feel like that's almost like it feels like a slang term from like a specific part of the world. Like maybe it's like America, like, oh, he sure can pick him. It's like, doesn't seem like something that Gideon would say at all.
Yeah, I think it is pretty American. This is the chapter where we get our plan. So this is what you've alluded to for the last couple of weeks, that we get some kind of structure going here. So we have a big meeting of all the planeswalkers who have currently been brought to Ravnica, and spends a long time with just like Gideon looking around, naming every single bloody planeswalker that's in the room. They spend a lot of time talking about Obnixilus. I'm like, why is Obnixilus sitting there talking to them? Obnixilus is like he's like heckling from the crowd. Like what's going on? He's supposed to be like an evil, like Gideon goes into his memories of him thinking, you know, oh, they've been enemies at one time or another. Literally, Obnixilus in the, you know, the backstory on Zendikar, he nearly killed Gideon by shoving his face in a puddle.
Yeah, exactly.
We all really enjoy.
Yeah.
So I feel like the animosity should be greater there. And even in these trying circumstances, they probably shouldn't be willing to work with Obnixilus, and he probably wouldn't be willing to work with them.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think it would be very interesting to have, like, it could be, I feel like this, it's a trope we see a lot. God, the only example I can think of is, can I remember these characters' names? It's like when the first episode of Lost, two of the characters are fighting. I think it's Sawyer and the other guy, what was his name?
Locke?
Basically, what's, remember his name?
Locke? No?
No, I think it's like a Pakistani guy, or Indian guy. I can't remember his name. Basically, it's like they're fighting because it's like you know, part of their, or supposed to be part of his kind of previous, you know, his prejudices and his previous kind of thoughts are kind of surfacing, and it's like they're fighting over something, and it's kind of, you know, he's making some like racist remarks and stuff, and it's kind of part of Sawyer's growth is realizing that, you know, all that stuff doesn't matter now because we're in a much bigger situation. So I kind of feel like I feel like it could have been this could be a great opportunity to have something like that, you know, like that happen, where kind of maybe Gideon and Odysseus are at odds when they first meet, and it maybe breaks out in actual combat or actual conflict, and then they have to both resolve it themselves. We'll have to overcome it themselves, which could show great, which should, you know, show you know, strength and growth in both the characters. But no, he's kind of, instead of doing that kind of interesting thing, Odysseus is just being relegated to a heckler.
Saeed is the character's name.
Saeed, yeah, that's it. Yeah, Rocky, yeah.
Yeah, and then Gideon kind of like walks around, like meeting some of the other planeswalkers in a way that I feel is very, like, it's kind of like a bonding moment, but it almost feels like it's a bit unnecessary. Like, it feels like they're under too much pressure to be having this little moment with all these funny quips and things. Like, what happens here? Like, I like this part.
I liked it as well, actually.
But I kind of feel like it's a weird tonal thing. So, like, he walks around, sees a few of the planeswalkers, so blah, blah, blah. So he goes to Mu Yanling and Zhang Yanggu, who had both planeswalked to Ravnica from a place they called the Plain of Mountains and Seas, bringing Zhang's dog Mowu with them. "How did you cross the Blind Eternities with a dog?" Gideon asked, perplexed. "He's a magic dog," Zhang said, with a shrug, as if that explained everything. "He's made of rock," Mu offered, as if that somehow sufficiently filled in the gap. I really enjoyed that little exchange.
Yeah, actually, I laughed out loud at that, unironically. I was like, yes, here is a quip that Greg has done, and it is successfully funny. I feel like we should have another big red button of, no, we had a big red button of, "We have been introduced for our first character." So now we have our first genuine joke.
And we're
he's a magic dog.
We're halfway through the book.
There's been a lot of jokes so far that have fallen flat.
Did you just say fall?
Yeah, God, it's a fall flat.
You said falled. F-A-L-L-E-D.
Oh my God, did I?
Yeah.
I'm a writer.
I'm going to have to pull you up.
Tell you one time we're doing... Yeah, you're right. We can't criticize Greg's writing if you can't write ourselves.
Yeah.
Remember, I think before my Leaving Cert English Paper 2 exam, we were kind of talking about English Paper 1. English Paper 1 has a lot of essays and creative writing and stuff. Someone was saying, like, "Oh, I did this many pages. I wrote this many pages." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I said, yeah, for my essay, I writ 10 pages." And then someone said, "What? Adam, the past tense of write isn't writ." And then I was like, "Oh, yeah, sorry, excuse me." Then I corrected myself. I said, "I writed 10 pages." I was like, "Wait, what's the actual verb again? Wrote. Oh, right." I was not thinking of that.
Oh, dear. Irregular verbs. They're difficult.
A lot of jokes have fallen flat. But this is quite good. I did enjoy this.
I quite like the next paragraph as well. Because I like Angrath mainly. Gideon met the Minotaur Angrath, who was laughing boisterously with a woman of Innistrad named Arlen Cord, who had a pleasant smile that showed all her white teeth. All of them. That's a bit much. Angrath surreptitiously...
That's a big smile.
This is the part that I enjoyed. Angrath surreptitiously sniffed at the woman every time she turned to speak to Gideon. When she moved off, Angrath cocked his head in Arlen's direction and said knowingly, "Werewolf."
Yeah, I like that as well. Actually, I'm not quite sure. It's kind of like I think this is like a nice interaction to see between characters, and that builds both of the characters. That doesn't feel forced. That was nice. It's like, but you remember that you're talking to someone, and whenever you look away, you know, you just lean in for a subtle stealthy sniff.
Yeah, it's a well known phenomenon. Always at it.
Yeah. I feel like I maybe don't say it, I really liked Angrath in this chapter, but I think that's all he does. But I feel like a lot of the time, maybe Angrath comes up again later on. A lot of the time Angrath is introduced, he just seems like a very good character. He seems like he has strengths, weaknesses, and something he's fighting for, and things to empathize for. That he always seems like a very well-rounded character, even in such a short amount of space.
Yeah, well, I think he has like just such a clear character motivation that it's pretty easy to sympathize with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this little bit just made me want to read a short story by Greg where he tells us about like a planeswalker party, like that, like somebody's like Jace's birthday party or something, and everybody's invited. I would read that. I think Greg.
Oh yeah, Worcester.
Do a good job with that.
Oh yeah, I think there was some DLC for Mass Effect 3 that basically was all the characters having a party, and it was very nice, like as the world's falling apart, the universe is at stake, and here's some DLC of everyone just having a party, and it was quite well received, because it was kind of just, because something like Mass Effect, kind of like this has a wide spectrum of diverse characters, and their interactions are all very, very good. So I think
I also
something like that would be good.
I love that kind of concept of like a big dramatic story with a lot of stress and tension and pressure, and for it to have like a moment somewhere kind of close to the end that relieves the pressure in like a nice way and lets all the characters like express themselves and maybe like say goodbye or say things that they haven't said that they wanted to say. I love that in stories in general. Like, it's one of the things that I like about like Stranger Things is like a real, like Stranger Things is not amazing or anything like that, but it's a good feel good show that has those moments and has a lot of respect for its characters. So it allows its characters those moments. It happens in a lot of things, even stuff like really depressing movies like The Road. Like there's that scene, there's the part in The Road where the man and the boy find like a bunker, and they get to have showers and they get to sit down at a table and eat, and they're just so happy, and they're just like, or there's another part where they find the man gives the boy like a can of Coke, and he's just like, oh my god, this is amazing, because it's like the apocalypse and you're never ever going to have a can of Coke again, you're very lucky to have one in and they're just so happy that they're just laughing together, and I love moments like that in books and stories in general. So I think what you're describing in Mass Effect is similar to that, and in a way this is similar.
Yeah, definitely. It's on people gave up the last episode, last season of Game of Thrones, but that second episode where it was all the characters kind of interacting is so good, and it was like, I feel like that was like almost the pinnacle of all the character arcs. Just kind of nice interactions, just really just human interactions that kind of build the characters and see them interacting. And I think something you mentioned there, you said that Stranger Things has a lot of respect for its characters. I think that is very important. I think that's something that's really, it's something that it's clear that there's no respect for the characters in this book, because there's no there's very little humanization of them. There is a little bit here in this chapter, to be fair, and this is the kind of stuff I would like to see more of, rather than pages upon pages of info dumps.
Yeah, the Game of Thrones example is a perfect one, and I also think that episode was the best of the season. And this chapter does show glimpses of that, and hopefully we see a few more of those type of things going forward, but I don't know if we will.
Yeah, God, I'm reading the wiki now for Mass Effect. Citadel Party is the name of the DLC. Might have to replay this game. I also had a disappointing ending, but we don't have to get into that.
All right. Well, then the meeting kind of starts in earnest. Obnixilus does his little heckling stuff, and basically Jace explains their problems. I mean, he breaks it down into a few different things, but a stupid and funny thing that I found about this whole section was that they just kept adding problems. They were like, okay, we have five things that we need to do. Oh, no, wait, okay, it's six. Oh, no, wait, actually, seven. Good point. Yeah, we need to do seven things.
Yeah, and that was I think it was done. It's supposed to be, obviously, comical, but then the chapter closes with Jace saying, all right, so we got six challenges, six missions. We need volunteers now. It's like, what? No, we thought it was seven. I remember when I read that, I was like, wait, wasn't it seven? And I read back, like, yeah, it is seven.
Yeah.
It was, five, six, seven.
Maybe one of them was, like, not counted or something like that. One of them is, like, an extra thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Definitely went up to seven and back down to six, which was confusing. I like this little bit as well here. Jace looked at Ralzarek, who shrugged, knowing what Jace was about to say. One, so this is the first problem. The Izzet's beacon is luring more and more unsuspecting planeswalkers to Ravnica, where they run the risk of becoming more fuel for Bolas's power. As if to illustrate the point, another planeswalker materialized in the middle of the crowd amid a flash of turquoise light. He was an older man with turquoise eyes and a carefully trimmed white beard. Gideon whispered to Jace, could you have planned that any better?
I highlighted that as well. I enjoyed that. Because it's like, yeah, we get it, Greg. You're this good symbolism. Like, he didn't even tell us about how apt that was, because it's quite clear it is apt.
I mean, literally, it says, as if to illustrate the point at the start of that explanation, and then Gideon comments on it. So both before and after, he's telling us that, oh, this is so apt.
Yeah. I think the second one by itself would be fine. If it has happened and then described the Planeswalker, then Gideon says, could you plan that any better? That would be great. But yeah, to do it, to be like, hey, here comes a funny joke. I'm going to tell the joke. Wasn't that a funny joke? It's like, we don't need that twice.
Yeah, that is pretty much, that is the best analogy for it.
We are, because the next line we have some more adverb abuse. I mean, there's no point to say, because it's everywhere. But Jay sighed heavily. Yeah, obviously that probably is fine to a lot of readers, but in my head, just alarm bells just go off my brain when I see adverbs like that. Jay sighed heavily and went on. Now here's another clever symbolism from Greg Weissman. We need to disable the beacon, which is under Izzet and Azorius guard at the aptly named Beacon Tower. It's like, why is that called anything else? Was it not, did it not have a name before the beacon was built?
No.
And it's like, I feel like, I think this is a line, we could do a deep dive into this, because I think this line alone tells us so much about how this book was written, because it seems like, yeah, maybe, like, I don't know, is Beacon Tower, is that a card in the War of the Spark set?
I think it is a card, or,
yeah. So it's like, this is a speculation, but I feel like, yeah, when design was making the card set, they had the card, yeah, to represent the beacon, like, oh, yeah, here's Beacon Tower, the card, Beacon Tower, it's where the beacon is. And then it's like, almost like that information was put together and given to Greg, and then, you know, for him to write the story. So it's very video gamey the way it just happens to be called Beacon Tower, because it literally is based on a game. But it's like, it's almost like he didn't have the freedom to change the name into something better, that he had to call it Beacon Tower. Like it's... Because then it's like, everyone's just on board just calling it Beacon Tower, capital B, capital T, because that's where the beacon is. And it's like, so that's just accepted now, that's just the name of the tower. Does it do any, is there anything else in the tower? Is it just a tower for the beacon?
The card is Interplanar Beacon, but it shows the tower.
Okay, right, yeah, so maybe that's top. That's not quite accurate what I'm saying there, but I feel like it's just like, all right, everybody, from now on, this tower is called Beacon Tower and nothing else. And it's like, surely Greg should have had the freedom to say, oh, the beacon was in, you know, the old Johnson Tower, you know, like he could have called it anything. He decided to call it the Beacon Tower. It's where the beacon is.
Yeah, it really just kind of, it feels like he just, you know, made a load of stuff up on the spot. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Call this Beacon Tower. That sounds good. Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah, and there's no one corrected him, or no one said, hey, why not give this a different name? You know, you're literally writing this book. You can make, you have the freedom to make shit up. But he opted not to.
Yeah, probably. Is it the same thing with the Immortal Sun? Is that in the Immortal Sun Tower? Or is it just in Azorius Tower, is it?
No, it's in the new Prav Towers. Those towers have a name.
Yeah. So what?
The Beacon Tower didn't have a name.
Like, the Beacon Tower, it's obviously in, like, is it territory, I guess, because Ral built it. So can't it be, I don't know, Steamworks Tower or something? I don't know.
God, yeah. It's like, sure, you could have just fought, you know, since he liked, I don't know, Operation Desperation, if that's the kind of things he names. You know, why didn't he just call it, I don't know, the Tower of Power? That would have been great. That would be in character for him.
Love it.
I wouldn't know. Beacon Tower.
Tower of Power.
Yep.
That's the name of my band.
I like it.
All right, then we've got a bunch of other problems that they go through. Basically all the little MacGuffins that they need to deal with, including Liliana, the fact that she's controlling the Dreadhorde. They need to close the portal, blah-de-blah-de-blah. I like the last one that Jay says is, finally, 5, Bolas himself. Oh yeah, forgot about that one. Yeah, we need to deal with that.
Oh, it's a big dragon. Yeah, that's the problem.
And he says, if we can't deal with the first 4 problems, the 5th is pretty damn hopeless.
Yeah.
Another general murmur echoed that sensation of hopelessness. What does that mean? I've never heard a hopeless general murmur.
Oh, fucking hell.
And then this is, this struck me as a good example of, like, as we've already mentioned, the citizenry and the urchins. In the next paragraph, Gideon stepped forward. There's a sixth problem. We have a responsibility to protect ordinary Ravnikans, since none would be in danger if not for Bolas's hunger for Planeswalker sparks. So, like, it almost seems like that, you know, the normal, you know, in response, Jay says, that's right, six problems. it feels like they just all forgot about the normal people, which I feel like maybe Greg also forgot about them until he got to this exact point when he was writing.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like, I think it's almost like okay for him to forget, because it's almost like not relevant to this. They're talking about a plan to take down Bolas, which, I mean, sure, passively they will try to protect the citizenry and the urchins of Ravnica if they could. I'm sure they would. Yeah, it seems, it's like, does this have to be, like, is the responsibility a problem? Like, it's, is it a thing that has to be addressed? I mean, there are already, so yeah, the actual problem is, yeah, we have a responsibility to protect ordinary Ravnikans. I mean, they're doing that anyway. That's going to happen anyway. I don't know why it has to be included. Unless, like you said, yeah, Greg did forget about it. He remembered it, and he feels the need to emphasize it here to make sure we know that he didn't forget about it, even though he did.
Yeah, and then maybe that's the one that disappears in the final count when it goes from 7 back down to 6. They're just like, they have already forgotten about the citizen.
Yeah, it does. It is, yeah, on the next page it goes down, but it's like, yeah.
It goes up to 7 when Ral Zarek says they need to reconstitute the guild pact by uniting all 10 guilds. So they have a clear,
yeah, which,
they have a clear set of goals here. They need to shut down all of Bolas's doohickeys. They need to kill Bolas. They need to restore the guild pact. And they need to not have too many urchins die while they're doing that.
Oh, and boy, it sure is a relief to have a plan structure in place now. I feel a lot more. I feel like I know what's going on. It's a feeling I've not had for the last half of this book. Are we halfway through?
Yep.
Do you feel better now? That I think a lot of our complaints before was how a lot of this book just felt like stuff was happening, that there was no structure. Does it feel like there's more structure now? Do things feel better for you?
Kind of. Well, like, as we see here at the end of this chapter, they start to... Well, hold on, actually. Let me just double check. At the end of this chapter, they start to split up into teams, right? So they're like, oh, you go and deal with this.
Yep.
I'll go and deal with Liliana, blah, blah, blah. Is that right?
Actually, I don't even think so. Did they actually split up? The later chapter had Dak Faden with a group of people. And there was exposition there to say, oh, well, here's what happened when he joined this team. I don't think we actually see them be split up.
Okay, yeah, maybe we don't see it in this chapter, but I assume that that's what's going to happen. They're all going to split up into teams and go after each particular thing.
Yeah, yeah. Is it whelming?
I like how a lot of people, some of the planeswalkers, step forward and are like, oh, we should join the dragon, or we should just hide.
Exactly. Bolas is never sated. That's what Vivian says.
Yeah.
Maybe he will decide he'll go away. It's like, what? I like that there is some. Discourse, or not discourse. There's some. What's word I'm looking for? There is some conflict between the characters, between Planeswalkers during the speeding, which I did like.
Yeah.
I liked that they were. Yeah. They were a bicker amongst themselves. This felt like too much. It's like no one's really going to consider that. Come on. Apart from Dombri Raid. Fuck.
I found the bit where they go from 7 to 6. So Jay said, all right, Jay said, before the crowd could splinter into argumentative factions, 7 goals, or 6 anyway, if we subtract going after Bolas for the time being. So that's the...
Okay, okay.
Which kind of makes sense.
Okay, that's good.
They can't
do
that until after the other things. But it does give you that kind of video gamey feel. It feels like, you know, like in a Zelda game where you have to get like the hookshot before you can go to the Goron Mountain or whatever.
Yeah, actually, it is like it's like unlocking the next part of the quest. It's like I've been going back and forth in my head as to whether or not I'd like that, but I think it is fine, even though it is very video gamey. And I think one complaint we had for a lot of this book so far has been that it was very video gamey and very it was very visual. He's just describing a movie he made up in his head. But I think kind of the video, this, something like this being video gamey is good, or is fine, because yeah, it is just bringing structure to the story, and was so needed. I am quite relieved that we do have, we really kind of know what's happening now.
Yeah, I think it is definitely a good thing regardless of how we feel about the individual quests that they may be going on. I think it is definitely good to have a bit of structure. And then the chapter finishes off with a bit of kind of a rallying moment where everybody puts their arms on Gideon. We've seen this in a card. It's a Pledge of Unity, I think, is the card. But Gideon like takes out his black blade and he's like, oh, I'm gonna kill the big dragon. This is a good sword. It kills dragons. And then Ajani puts his hand on his arm, and then everyone just starts to touch him. I think it's supposed to be like one of those like real special moments, but it just doesn't come across as that. I'm just like, okay.
You know, I think it is supposed to be like, you have my bow and my axe, my sword. But it's and you know, one reason why I think it doesn't come across as being a very galvanizing moment is because immediately after it happens, Greg tells us that it was a galvanizing moment. So it's almost like he feels like this. I mean, this maybe I feel like this is actually the worst example. The best example of like very very bad writing is that you know, we thought they show don't tell before, how you gotta show us what's happening rather than telling us what's happening. So it almost feels like, because it's supposed to be such a powerful moment, but it happens, it's so brief. It is only like a few lines long. So it feels like, it's as if Greg feels like he can just tell us that it was a galvanizing moment in the text without having to show us, without having to make it in the moment feel galvanizing. It's almost like he truly believes that the line, it was a galvanizing moment, makes up for just how brief and almost rushed this supposedly powerful scene is.
Yeah, like I'm looking at it here, it's really just one paragraph, and it feels like this is like a moment that is really important and should be given more weight, maybe should be described from a few different characters' point of view and like describing their feelings as it happens, but none of that really is present. Can I read the paragraph?
Yeah, go on. But yeah.
Might read it. Like it also like abruptly switches tack after that moment, which is fine, I think, but it's just too abrupt. So yeah, he's like, he says, who's with me? That's his big moment. And then he said, his speech roused the crowd, which began to gather around him. Ajani put a hand on his shoulder, and that simple gesture acted as a trigger. From every side, planeswalkers and Ravnikans reached out their hands to touch Gideon, or if farther back, to touch someone touching Gideon, as if to draw strength from the strength of his conviction. It was a galvanizing moment. Gideon felt Jace Beleriand's touch within his mind. He had remained up on the dais and was smiling down at Gideon Jura. I don't know how you do it, Jace thought to him, but I'm damn glad you do. This part is great. Just then, a small Izzet goblin entered from a balcony door, shouting, Masters, one of them God Eternals approaches at the head of a small army of those undead creepies. You got about 11.5 minutes, 4 days here.
That is wonderful.
I want to see that.
I feel like...
I want to see that televised. I want to see a visual representation of that.
Of a Brooklyn goblin.
Yeah.
That is wonderful. Yeah, it's like, I mean, that is definitely what, the way you described it there is definitely what he was going for. I feel it feels almost overly comical that it's a small goblin bursting through the doors. Like, everybody's galvanizing moment has to stop because the God Eternals are here. Undead creepies. That is wonderful. Ooh, and then I like Gideon's response, 11 and a half minutes. One has to admire, is it precision?
Six challenges, six missions. We need volunteers, now. And that's the end of the chapter.
Okay, yeah, so presumably that's like, this is immediately before the groups start forming. So we see the groups forming, or see, we kind of, when we come back to this, the groups have formed.
Okay, they've all set out on their own missions.
Oh, yes.
All right, well...
Yeah, so that's...
I feel like that...
That's structure.
Yeah, it gave us some structure, had a lot of ups, had a lot of downs. I feel reinvigorated a little bit for this book. I was kind of at the end of my rope with it a little bit, but now I feel like I have a bit more patience and I'm willing to see it through.
Yeah, I actually felt something reading this chapter. I felt excitement. I felt kind of a buzz of excitement, a buzz of tension. You could say it was a galvanizing moment. As I was reading this, because like it was so much. The story really felt like it was just floundering and flopping around. You know, with no direction, with no drive before this. It's kind of my complaint is that a chapter like this hasn't happened previously. This should have been a lot sooner, I think. That was 32 chapters in, and then we finally get a feel for what's going on.
All right, well, here we are, chapter 33. We're pretty much officially halfway through the book, and now we know what's going to happen.
That is good. Maybe the relief you have is from knowing that there's not much left.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's another half left, so we've as much as we've already read again. But, you know, we're past the halfway point now. It's all downhill from here.
Yeah, it's like we said earlier on that we might, what's the word? We kind of thought that the book was going to end any minute because we were like, hey, everything has happened, you know. When we're finding God Eternals, it's like, oh, well, yeah, we're only 33% through the book and the God Eternals have arrived. So I thought that was going to be later on. I mean, I think it's just going to be over soon. In my head, there was some kind of hope that it would just end very quickly. That, like, you know, that my Kindle was wrong in its percentage of how much was left. I think, what was it I was reading? I was reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and that just felt like it was ended out of nowhere. I think the percentage of my Kindle was telling me was wrong, and it just felt like it ended in the middle of a scene. There was no kind of build up or climax at the end. So I was kind of worried something like that would happen, that the book was going to end. This book was going to end at any minute, but now we know it has to happen, and there's going to be stuff.
Yeah,
we'll be excited.
Plenty more to read. All right, it's been a long episode this week. Those chapters have been, I think, by far the longest in the book.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, boy, don't worry, they get short again.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. Short, snappy chapters.
Boom, in and out. Well, the next chapter is a Kaya chapter.
Oh, yes, I usually do say that. I didn't give any alternate titles today, actually, because I forgot to take notes for these two chapters.
You were so wrapped up in the moment.
Exactly. I was so galvanized.
I think galvanizing moment is the name of this chapter, at least.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, so next week we have... think it is next week where we learn about Rat's power. Why Rat is invisible.
Oh, nice. Okay. Looking forward to that.
Oh my god, so disappointing.
Oh no.
Prepare to be whelmed. Prepare to be disappointed. And will I read out this one? It's a very short chapter, but I made a few notes. But as a teaser for next episode, I've written the words, Centaur Godfather... Greg, that's bullshit.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
We'll get some context for that later. We'll get some context for that next week. Fuck's sake, Greg.
I'm looking forward to that now. All right, that's going to do it for us this week. If you want to get in touch with us, tell us anything, any of your opinions about the book, or let us know things that you like, don't like, you can get us on Twitter at our personal Twitter handles. I am at Govanan, G-O-V-A-N-N-A-N. And Al, you are at?
I am at Alan Harrison. That is Alan, spelled A-L-A-N. And Harrison, spelled like Alan Harrison, who was a host of another podcast called Skullcrack.
Oh my god.
That's who I am.
I already got to the...
I have ran out of famous Harrisons for this segment. So I think for next week, we should make an actual Twitter page for this podcast.
Oh yeah.
So we don't have to do that anymore. Yeah, there's a reason why we wouldn't.
Maybe.
I'll set that up. Yeah.
All right, okay. We'll retire this segment. All right. Do it for us. Bye-bye.
Bye.